WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The short days and long nights of winter leave a lot of people feeling depressed. My guest, Dr. Norman Rosenthal, has spent the past 20 years studying the effects of the seasons on mood. He's a senior researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health, and he led the first team that investigated what is now called seasonal affective disorder, known by the acronym SAD. In fact, Dr. Rosenthal coined the name. He's convinced that exposure to certain types of artificial light can help reverse certain forms of winter depression. He's just revised his book, Winter Blues. I asked him to describe the typical symptoms of SAD, seasonal affective disorder.
People with SAD have a typical cluster of symptoms year after year. As the days begin to get short and dark, they have difficulty waking up in the morning. They tend to oversleep. They feel slowed down. It's harder to think, to concentrate. They tend to eat sweets and starches and, as a consequence, to gain weight. And after a while, they begin to feel sad and down and anxious and withdraw from friends and family. And this happens year after year in the winter. And as the spring comes, these symptoms all tend to get better again.
Now, I always thought that was just a normal reaction to the season changes.
Well, I think that's an indication of how common the problem is. We figure that about 1 in 5 people have some difficulty with the winter. And how you classify that really depends on how severe it is. For example, people who simply are a little under the weather or have some difficulty with creativity or productivity and just don't enjoy themselves as much, we say they're suffering from the winter blues. But that group of people, which is about 6% of the population, who really feel somewhat disabled, somewhat impaired by the winter, would suffer from SAD or seasonal affective disorder. And how you'd know that is that there are problems with their bodily functions. They really oversleep. They really can't get up in the morning. They're having real difficulty concentrating to such a degree that their job suffers, or they're so withdrawn that their relationships suffer. Once it's beginning to impact on function to that degree, then we say you've got SAD.
How does seasonal affective disorder compare to regular depression?
Well, it is a kind of a depression, but the first clue is its timing. Regular depressions can pop up at any old time, whereas with SAD, it's this very regular occurrence. The second thing is that it seems very reactive to the environmental light. So if for any reason people aren't getting enough light, even if it's in the middle of the summer and it's a spell of 2 or 3 cloudy weeks, people could experience the symptoms of SAD. That's not so characteristic of ordinary depression. And then this very exquisite response, which we will presumably talk about, to light therapy is another hallmark of seasonal affective disorder. And then regular depressives oftentimes don't really want to eat. They lose weight, they can't sleep enough, they have a different clinical picture, and they're more likely to commit suicide. Somehow, the problem of suicide in depression occurs when a person is energized and activated, which some depressed people are, but people with SAD are usually the opposite. They're slowed down, they're sluggish, and the one advantage of that is that they're less likely to harm themselves.
What are some of the theories about why light should affect mood?
Well, we know that the body takes in light in various ways. Firstly, it comes in through the eyes. Secondly, it comes in through the skin. And we've known for years, for example, that ultraviolet light causes vitamin D synthesis in the skin. That's very important for calcium absorption. What's really quite new is this recognition that coming in through the eyes, light has many signals that it gives to the brain via connections between the retinas of the eyes and a special part of the brain called the hypothalamus. And we have got theories as to how the light may actually modify brain functioning, one involving a very common nerve chemical or neurotransmitter called serotonin, one involving a hormone that is secreted at night called melatonin, and other such explanations. And of course, when there are so many explanations, you can bet nobody knows for sure which one is correct.
Now, I know one of the remedies that you've been experimenting with for many years is light, artificial light, through the use of light boxes that can be used in the home or the office. What does a typical light box look like?
A light box varies in size, but a typical box would be maybe 1.5 foot by 2 foot, a rectangle. And it sits upon a desk or tabletop. It's got a metal or wooden frame. It's got several fluorescent tubes in it and a plastic diffusing screen in the front. And it sits upright or at a slight angle towards the eyes. And the user sits maybe 1 foot, 2 foot away from the light fixture, depending on the exact nature of it, and remains there in that position for 30 minutes to even 2 hours per day.
How bright are the lights that you've worked with in your studies compared to, say, the typical brightness in a kitchen or an office?
These lights are between 5 and 20 times as bright as ordinary indoor lighting. In fact, light is measured in a measurement called lux, L-U-X, and the typical light fixtures are between 2,500 and 10,000 lux, whereas an ordinary indoor room will only be about 300 to 500 lux.
Are you likely to get eye strain from this intense light?
Some people can, and if they do, I recommend they just back off a little and then they can often ratchet it up again.
What are some of the other side effects?
Headaches can similarly occur, or if you use it late at night, you can keep people up and cause a little insomnia, so you may want to do the light therapy a little earlier during the day. And I should mention that the morning hours have proven to be the most effective for light therapy in general, even though some people also enjoy using it later in the day as well.
Now, it's interesting to me that you should be using fluorescent lights in the light boxes. I'm one of those people who thinks of myself as hating fluorescent light. It's one thing I don't like about most offices and a lot of fast food restaurants. I would think that a lot of intense fluorescent light would make me more irritable as opposed to easing my depression.
Well, it certainly might, and not everybody likes it. One feature of some of these modern boxes is that they remove the very irritating flicker from the fluorescent light, which is quite a pleasure because that can really get on one's nerves. The other thing, of course, is that you're only using it for a time-limited amount, so it's not like you're sitting in it all day long. But I agree with you that it's nice to balance the light in the room with other kinds of lights as well so that you don't just get this total blue-white fluorescent glare.
Now, have you experimented with better windows? A lot of people work in dark offices, and in that respect, it could be any season, and you wouldn't know the difference while you're at work.
There are no actual experiments on windows, but I can tell you from extensive clinical observations that the more light you bring into the home, the better. And I always recommend to my patients, if they're purchasing a new house, you know, be sure that you've got large windows and that they're facing south. And this is a problem for people who buy houses in the middle of the summer because the house may look very bright then, but it may be gloomy as anything in the wintertime. And I recommend that they trim the bushes and trees from around the windows and that they give the coat of grime that's sort of settled on the windows from summer a good wash, because all of this is going to bring more light into the home.
My guest is Dr. Norman Rosenthal, the author of Winter Blues. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Norman Rosenthal, a senior researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health. He studies the effects of seasonal changes on mood. How did you first become aware of, well, your own symptoms? Because you write in your book that you have winter blues symptoms that you've had to deal with.
Well, yes, I come from South Africa, where the seasons are very mild and blend easily one into the other. And I came to New York City to do my psychiatric residency, and that was the summer of 76, which was the bicentennial year, and the tall ships were sailing down the Hudson. And the summer days seemed endlessly long, and my energy seemed boundless. So I got into all kinds of projects as a resident, and little did I anticipate the impact of the daylight savings time change on me, when all of a sudden at 4:30 in the afternoon it was dark outside. And I could feel something switching inside me, and it was as though I had a sense of foreboding, you know, what's going on over here, a sense of panic, and a feeling of slowing down and having a hard time getting everything accomplished, and just hanging in there. I sort of, for the first time, I understood the stoical temperaments of the northern people who sort of grit their teeth and just kind of hang in and endure, which is what I did until spring came. And then things began to loosen up and my energy returned. And I thought, now, you know, what was that fuss all about? You can do all this stuff. And so it went for 3 consecutive years until I came down to the National Institute of Mental Health to do research. And the group I joined was working in mood disorders and rhythms and the effects of light. And at that time, we encountered a man, an engineer, who had a long history of seasonal depressions that he had chronicled very thoroughly and had actually thought, he speculated, that it might be related to the amount of environmental light. And the penny sort of dropped, and I thought, yeah, this is very familiar. This is kind of interesting. So we treated him with more light and brought him out of his depression. And then we thought, well, you know, you can't make much of a story out of just one case. We need a group of people. So we approached a journalist. She put an article in the newspaper, in the Washington Post. And I thought, you know, in a big metropolitan area, maybe I would get a handful of respondents. But instead, there were thousands of people. And what became apparent was that this is really a common problem. But I think what gave me the conviction to spend many years of my life studying it was the intuitive sense that this is real. A lot of people are affected by it. It's going to tell us something important about our response to our physical environment.
What were your first studies like?
The first study was rather primitive. We had a light box. The placebo light box was a sort of yellow light. And we dimmed it with brown paper. We had a very sort of spare budget at that time. So it had a very early mom and pop kind of quality to it. But what was so impressive was when those first light responders appeared. Because after 3 or 4 days, people who had been literally disabled suddenly were active, were functioning, were happy, and were convinced that it was the light. And that was a terribly exciting time. And I remember being away from a conference and calling my colleague and saying, how is Mrs. So-and-so? And he said, look, I don't know what you're giving her, but she's just blooming like a rose. And so it was a very exciting first study. It was flawed. It had its problems. But in fact, the fundamental finding has been proven to be correct, that bright light does help more than dim light, and it's not just a placebo.
What's the current research that you're working on now?
Currently, I'm rather interested in the genetics of SAD. We are developing cell lines from our patients and their families because now you can probe the human genome and look for various parts of the genome that you suspect might be implicated. For example, now we can look at the genes for serotonin and see whether there's any evidence that people with SAD have variants of those genes that are different from those who don't have SAD. And in fact, we have come up with a couple of these variants that seem to be more common in SAD than in a control population. The other thing that we're doing is we're continuing to try to understand the influence of melatonin on SAD symptoms. The patterns of melatonin that shift across the seasons seem different in patients and controls, and we're trying to tease out the complexities of these differences.
Dr. Norman Rosenthal is a senior researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health. His newly revised book is called Winter Blues.